You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 21st of May 2014 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Coming up on today's programme, John Everard and Martin Plout will be here to review the day's top news stories, from Nigeria to Bangkok to Bunga Bunga. Then we'll look at a new documentary that explores the companies and fabrics redefining what we wear and how we wear it.
I think our relationship with clothes in 20 years will be really interesting. I wonder if we'll even wear clothes or we'll fully have digital skin.
I think we'll probably still wear clothes. Later in the show...
We pull up to this castle!
They're in Downton Abbey!
There's butlers and maids standing there to greet you with English accents. It was the cutest thing ever.
We'll be previewing the week's best and the worst in the world of TV. All that, plus we head to Lisbon ahead of Europe's biggest football match, and there'll also be music, I promise. That's Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield, starting right now. As ever, a huge amount to pack in over the next 60 minutes. First of all, here's Paul Osborne with the latest news headlines from around the world.
Almost 50 people are now thought to have been killed in three attacks on villages in the northeast of Nigeria, which have been blamed on Islamist militants. They happened close to the town where more than 200 schoolgirls were abducted by Boko Haram. Militants shot people and set fire to houses the day after 118 were killed in a double bomb attack in the city of Jos. Elliot Engel, who's a member of the US House of Representatives, says it's vital the US lead a global effort to find the kidnapped girls.
We believe very strongly that the United States, in conjunction with other countries, must do everything possible to free those girls. And we have technology that other countries don't have that we believe should be utilized in a joint international effort to bring the girls home.
Russia has agreed to supply China with natural gas in a massive multi-billion dollar deal. It's been signed by the Russian President Vladimir Putin after a decade of negotiations. Though the precise details of the deal have not been released, it's thought to be worth $400 billion over 30 years. News of the deal came as the US Vice President Joe Biden warned it's vital that European nations find a stable alternative to their reliance on Russian energy supplies. He also warned Russia not to interfere in Ukraine's presidential election, which takes place this weekend. Meanwhile, NATO's Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen has again said there is no evidence to support Russian claims to have withdrawn thousands of troops from the Ukrainian border.
I wake up every morning hoping to see a real and meaningful withdrawal of Russian troops. But I have to tell you that so far, we haven't seen any visible evidence of a withdrawal of Russian troops.
The former Egyptian president, Hosni Mubarak, has been sentenced to 3 years in prison for embezzling public funds. His two sons were given four-year terms for the same offence, accused of stealing more than $17 million. Meanwhile, 155 members of the Muslim Brotherhood have been given long prison sentences in a mass trial. More than 50 were sentenced to life, accused of violence in protests that followed the ousting of the president, Mohamed Morsi. A two-hour emergency meeting of political leaders in Thailand has ended with no conclusive result, the day after the army imposed martial law. They discussed political reforms and how to end months of demonstrations in the country. Though there was no agreement, there'll be a further meeting on Thursday.
He's taking a lot of risks, General Prayut, because the imposition of martial law puts him in a very tight spot. This means that the military is in charge. This means he's responsible. So with that responsibility, he has to act quickly. The longer we do not see a resolution, the riskier it will become for the army.
And that was Thai political analyst Ditinan Ponsuttilak. Pakistan says it's killed 60 militants in airstrikes in the province of North Waziristan. Military officials say the dead include a number of important Taliban commanders, but the strikes could threaten attempts to stage peace talks with militant groups in Pakistan. Meanwhile, India has invited Pakistan's leader to the inauguration of the country's new prime minister, but it's not clear if Nawaz Sharif will attend next week's swearing-in of Narendra Modi, whose BJP won a landslide victory in India's general election. The party says the invite to Mr. Sharif is designed to encourage greater dialogue between India and Pakistan. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Paul Osborne, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House. We're back after this.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. See on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. It's 18:06 in London. It's 13:06 in New York City. Joining me now here in the studio is John Everard, former British ambassador to Belarus, Uruguay and North Korea, and Martin Plaut, fellow at the Institute of Commonwealth Studies. John, Martin, welcome to the programme. We're going to begin in Asia, and perhaps, John, let's start in Thailand with the coup that's not a coup. We can call it a coup, though, can't we?
Well, no, not really. A coup would be where the military actually assume government. They have studiously avoided doing that. They have made themselves responsible for street order, and I think a lot of people will be quite glad they've done that. But the government continues to function. Now, OK, the government wasn't consulted on the military's move, but so far the military have not impeded the government from carrying on. So what effectively they've done, they haven't tried to cut the Gordian knot of this particularly complex Thai political crisis. What they've tried to do is to prevent things getting any worse. I think there were general fears around Thailand that if matters were left to run, that there would be street fighting very soon and that probably the casualty rate would start to rise very sharply.
But Martin, it's understandable why some people look at this and worry whenever the military step in and say, don't worry, we're just here to sort out law and order. Everyone get back to doing what they're doing. Don't mind us. We're just making sure that everything's okay.
Well, I mean, you know, Thailand isn't really an area I know a great deal about, but I understand that they've been in power, the military, for, they've had something like 18 coups since the 1930s. It sounds as if this is a well-trodden path. But luckily for us, Thailand has a simple problem, which is yellow and red, and it's split down the middle. You have one lot that wear red shirts, and they tend to be from the countryside and be poorer, and you have another lot who are in yellow shirts and tend to be from the rural areas and the middle classes and so forth. So it's terribly helpful because you have a divergence, and you can at least see who's on which side. So that is at least a help for those of us who are not specialists in the area. But I'm sure John will fill in what I've managed to leave out.
But John, I mean, there is this issue that, you know, that they're saying that there, don't worry, there will be elections.
Yes.
We are going to have fresh elections. There were elections in February, and the government that's in power now won them quite handily.
Yes, that's right.
As they have pretty much every election, you know, in the past few years.
Close to the core of this problem is the fact that those who oppose the current government know that in a nationwide poll, they are going to lose every time. That the huge mass of rural voters will continue to support the Shinawatra dynasty. And that there's a sense of desperation, therefore, amongst the protesters. The calling for what they call a neutral prime minister, quite what that means in practical terms isn't clear, and trying to work towards some kind of system that isn't actually a full voting democracy. They call this defending the king. I think this sent a bit of a shiver down a lot of spines.
Let's move on to China and Russia, who have sort of reached a deal over gas today. Vladimir Putin has been in Shanghai. I say sort of because the gas isn't going to flow until 2018. Martin, when we look at the situation with Russia and how they're trying to sort of see who their friends still are in the world, the fact that they're turning to China and saying, hey, don't worry, we're close friends, they're reliable partners. If you were to look at history, it wouldn't suggest that China and Russia are always necessarily going to get on as well as Vladimir Putin is suggesting.
Well, absolutely not. But I mean, you know, I think it's a mistake to see this as necessarily related to the current crisis that there is, shall we say, between Russia and the West. After all, this whole project has been negotiated for a decade. You don't have 10-year plans when you have immediate crises. That's just not the way things can be done. But I mean, it may have forced the pace of negotiations, and that particularly the Chinese are ruthlessly hard in their negotiating skills and bringing down the price of energy, which they obviously want. But the Russians, though, they're up against quite a tough situation where there is now much more natural gas available. And for example, the East Africans are beginning to liquefy their gas. They know in due course they will be able to send this to the Chinese. So the Russians were in a position where they had to actually make a deal. This is a good time to make that deal, but it's a huge amount of money. I think something like $400 billion over the period.
John, is this a deal being made out of weakness from Vladimir Putin?
Absolutely. Putin has caved in, effectively. He sold the family silver. The price of paying for this gas is a commercial secret, says Gazprom. That's because it is so appallingly low, almost certainly, that it's going to provoke a political backlash in Moscow. Remember, this deal was signed at 4 o'clock in the morning. The Chinese took the Russians mercilessly right to the wire, and they have negotiated blood out of them. And as you said, the gas doesn't start flowing until 2018. Putin needs cash now. He doesn't get it out of this deal. Nor does he get what he really wanted, which was Chinese investment in the Russian gas fields. The deal says quite explicitly that that is a Russian responsibility. For all that, there are huge stage whispers that China has been given equity stakes in two of the largest fields. So, as I say, giving away the family silver. But economically, this deal is not going to help Russia anytime soon, possibly anytime ever. It is, however, deeply symbolic politically. The Chinese will have negotiated this, remembering all the times that that post-1949 China had to go cap in hand to the Soviet Union, to Big Brother, for help, aid, assistance, whatever. Putin's visit to Beijing this time marks emphatically, to Shanghai, I'm sorry, marks emphatically the moment that the roles are reversed. From here on in, it is China calling the shots in this relationship. This is not a relationship of equals.
A very historic moment, then.
Yes.
And Martin, when we look at this from an African perspective, as you say, you know, East Africa is starting to liquefy gas. There's been huge deals recently between China and East Africa. You had the Chinese premier in East Africa recently signing deals on to do with the railways and to do with all sorts of other things as well. If China can get Putin to cave and roll over in this way, then the combined might of Kikwete and Kenyatta and Kagame, amongst others, isn't really going to be able to stand up to China at all, is it?
Yes, but you mustn't forget that Africa doesn't matter to China. I mean, it's a nice to have. Yes, they need some of their minerals, but after all, you can buy minerals almost anywhere you like. But the Chinese, unlike, shall we say, all the other powers in the world, have long-term plans. And, you know, when they decided they want to have a relationship with Africa, they sent very senior people round the continent for years. They have a huge, shall we say, soft presence in Africa now, with their radio stations, with their whole network of correspondents. This is a vast investment, but they don't see it in a 5-year plan. This is 10 years, 20 years that they're looking at. And they have a different relationship with Africa from the rest of the world. They want what they can give them, but they don't give a damn about Africa.
We're going to move on in a moment to Nigeria and South Sudan, but John, before we do that, I just wanted to, unless you had something, you weren't just coming on that issue.
Could
first.
I please, yes, not so much the Chinese, the Africans. I just wanted to draw the camera back a bit and look at how this fits in with Putin's other concerns, and particularly the situation in Ukraine. I think over the last 14 days or so, we have watched Putin's position in Ukraine unravel very badly. We have seen the leader of the separatists in Donetsk saying he's only got 1,000 men, he can't get more volunteers despite having the arms to fight, as he says, the entire Ukrainian army. We've seen the Russian forces, all 40,000 of them, on the border, magnificently inert. They have not crossed the border, and with every day that passes, the threat that they provide becomes less and less credible. We've had Ukraine's main oligarch siding firmly with the Ukrainian state and making clear he has no trust in separatism. And then we have Putin's landmark deal with China going wrong on him. He's not getting the economic support he desperately needs. A very, very bad week for Vladimir Putin.
On that note, we'll take a short break. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield, my guests are John Everard and Martin Plaut. We're back to talk a bit about Africa and a couple of other things after this.
The entrepreneur seeks out the seers, the sages and the successes of the business world. Every week, we take you on an hour-long tour to uncover the hidden, extraordinary, curious and inspiring stories you won't hear anywhere else.
I don't see any borders between countries, if it's Japan, England, France. My approach is that I believe that people anywhere in the world, there are people who understand and appreciate it.
There's a push maybe that people want to have more of their stuff made locally because they know where it's coming from.
From the kiosk owners of Cairo to the coffee culture of Tel Aviv, from the beer brewers of Ghana to the piano makers of Greece. Intrigued? Well, tune in to hear how the best entrepreneurial minds tick, not just the ups and downs of the FTSE.
We didn't buy into a design studio or a commercial entity, we bought into a factory.
So, if you have an idea and want to drop that 9-to-5, you've just found your new business Bible.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time, in association with Pictet.
And you're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. My guests are John Everard and Martin Plaut. Let's turn now to Nigeria, where there's been yet more violence in the north of the country after the double bombing in the city of Jos yesterday. At least 17 people were killed in an attack in a village in the northeast of the country. Martin Plaut, it's how much of this is a real escalation of what's been going on for several years, and how much is just that actually all of a sudden the rest of the world is noticing?
No, it is a real escalation. I mean, the Nigerians have lost control of the northeast of the country. Their army is simply outgunned, outfaced by Boko Haram, who are better equipped and much more determined to press their case home at any cost. And frankly, there is almost nothing that the Nigerians can now do about this. I mean, they've called for help, and because of the terrible, kidnapping of these 200 girls, the rest of the world is now taking it seriously. I mean, when even the, Barack Obama takes it seriously, and his wife goes on television and saying, this is a really serious problem. I mean, it is a big political issue, but there's almost nothing that can be done about it. I just cannot see how you can put this genie back in the bottle. And if they hadn't slaughtered, if the Nigerian army and the police had not slaughtered Boko Haram right back at the beginning, this could be dealt with politically. But because of the political links between Boko Haram and some of the Nigerian elite, and because of the north-south split in Nigeria, there's nothing that can be done, I don't think.
At what stage did this start to fall apart? Take us back a little bit, because, I mean, not back too far, but but I mean, this was, I remember, going to Jos, and it was a city where it wasn't a Muslim city in the Muslim north of Nigeria. This was a very mixed city where actually, for a number of people, you wouldn't know if they were Muslim or Christian.
Absolutely. But then you have had, Christians have been fleeing to the south for years now. You've had buses loads of them. And you have the, Boko Haram is now not just a northern Nigerian phenomenon. I mean, the Cameroonians have come across previously and said, look, we're terribly worried because there's radicalization in our mosques. You now have a situation where you frankly have, to use a phrase, an arc of crisis going right the way through the center of Africa, of which you have people like Seleka in the Central African Republic, the Sudanese, there are elements who are now, these are all cooperating. And this is terribly, terribly dangerous. And now, if they weren't, they aren't a danger to the rest of the world, but to the people there, they are absolutely lethal.
And John Everard, part of the problem here is that, as Marta alluded to, that often the armed forces, the security forces in these countries either don't have the capability or don't have the willingness to confront them, or in some cases are actually complicit.
That's right. Boko Haram, as Martin said, are very determined, very well armed, and completely ruthless. And it seems that one of the main reasons that they were able to abduct these unfortunate schoolgirls was that although the local military was tipped off about the raid, they were just too scared to go in and do anything about it, fearful for their own lives. It's notable that even the president of Nigeria, Goodluck Jonathan, has avoided visiting the crisis area for security reasons. Now, if the president himself can't go in, what hope is there for lesser people?
Martin, you mentioned that it's very hard to put the genie back in the bottle once it's come out. How, I'm going to ask you to do that, or at least talk about how we can do that. Are there steps that can be taken? Because, as you say, it's because there is no clear good guy, in the sense that we can't just say, oh, well, let's give lots of support to the Nigerian army and they'll sort it out. How do we get to a situation where this sort of insecurity can be dealt with?
Well, the Americans have been trying to train various forces in Africa for years. They've put in a lot of resources. But frankly, nobody is prepared to put in international troops. You won't see American troops or British troops fighting this issue. The Africans have for a long time gone around saying we want African solutions to African problems, but they are incapable of running, a whelk stall, quite frankly. The African Union is a completely hopeless organization. They have just about...
They would argue that they've had some success in Somalia with the African Union force there, which has in some ways quashed al-Shabaab.
No, the African Union force has not quashed al-Shabaab. The Ugandan troops and the Ethiopian troops, with some help in a rather in cack-handed way but from the Kenyans, have done something, but not the African Union force. There is no real African Union force. There are those individual countries who see their own... they have their own raison d'etre for being there, but not the African Union. And the African Union is just they're just a shower.
But my argument is that there are African forces that were able to arguably make a difference there.
Yes, but they have to see it as being in their own direct interests. So, for example, the Ugandans went into South Sudan, and they were determined that Salva Kiir was not going to be overthrown. But that was because he was in their interests, not for the greater good of Africa.
John Everett, I want to move on now to the crisis in South Sudan, which Martin just mentioned there. We've had a donor conference yesterday in Oslo, where $600 million was pledged. Now, first of all, we can argue whether $600 million is enough. The UN says that it actually needs $1.8 billion. In your experience of working on these issues and knowing the way these often work, that $600 million might be a headline today, but there's no guarantee much of that money is going to be in the UN's pocket within the next few weeks, is there?
Different countries disperse at different speeds. Quite a lot of this money is actually coming from Western countries that have got generally quite reasonable records in moving money from their bank accounts to where it's needed with some dispatch. I think there's a much bigger question mark over the $590 million, I think it was, that's already been pledged, a lot of it coming from sources with rather less good records on actually getting the money out. And as you rightly point out, even if every last penny pledged is actually paid, we're only two-thirds of the way there. This is simply not enough money to deal with this enormous problem. And South Sudan looked in a very bad way.
And Martin, is that essentially what we're left with here? That if we were to look at the role of the West, it's we're very good at when things have gone really badly wrong, pony up some cash, or at least saying we can help with some humanitarian aid. But that's about it.
Yeah, and look, I'm sure that a lot will be done in the next few weeks and months ahead. I mean, but we are in desperate times. I mean, the rains, this is the rainy season. It's impossible to get food through to most of the areas. The roads have completely washed away by this time. They're a sea of mud. I mean, the Red Cross is talking about dropping food in from the air, which is the most expensive way of getting food in anywhere. But we are talking about a million people who have been driven from their homes and many more than that who have been unable to plant because of the terrible internal fighting inside South Sudan based on the Dinka-Nuer split within South Sudan.
And how does this compare to when you were covering the crisis in South Sudan in the 80s and the 90s, all through that horrendous civil war, which lasted just over 20 years, 2 million people lost their lives. Are we approaching that sort of level of disaster?
I think we are. In fact, I would say that the comparator is with the 84-85 famine in Ethiopia. That is how bad things could get. I'm not saying they will get that bad, but that is the threat. And we could be talking about tens of thousands of people, particularly the young and the elderly, who are likely to die by August. August is the sort of time when we'll really see things getting terrible. And you know how it will play out? Well, we'll see. The only good thing I would say is that the people of Sudan have for years and years relied on themselves and not on their government. So even though there's almost nothing coming to them, that's life as normal.
We've been talking about the trouble that the West can have in terms of living up to its ideals and its promises and what it's supposed to stand for. And I guess a very good example of exactly how much of a problem the West has had doing that can be found in the next person we're going to talk about, which is former Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi, fortunately now former. He gave an interview last night to the BBC, which was slightly unusual in that Jeremy Paxman, the presenter of the BBC programme Newsnight, is known for having a go at his guests and putting them on the spot. Even despite the fact there was a bit of a language barrier, he certainly managed to put Mr. Berlusconi on the spot.
Do you have a particular problem with Angela Merkel? Yeah. Is it true you called her an unf***able lard?
Non arrivare, io non ho mai.
But...
scusi, non ho mai, in 20 anni di politica, insultato nessuno.
No, I have never had any problems with Angela Merkel. In 20 years of politics, I have never insulted anyone. And this has been made up by someone who wanted to turn Angela against me.
È chiaro quindi che non ero un personaggio comodo.
I was not an easy person to deal with, and I was quite tough. I had the courage to oppose some of the proposals made by Merkel and Sarkozy.
Proposte che venivano dal duo Merkel-Sarkozy.
And the time when you jumped out from behind a monument and went cuckoo to Angela Merkel, that was just a joke, was it?
Ma lei...
She enjoyed it.
There we are. I'm not entirely sure where I had to bleep out lard ass, but still... John, it's, you know, we're laughing at it because it's ridiculous, because this guy was the democratically elected prime minister of one of the founding members of the European Union and still the fourth largest economy in Europe, despite him. And yet, you know, this does sum up, you know, quite neatly some of the problems the West has.
Well, yes, the Berlusconi is a rather unorthodox leader, or was a rather unorthodox leader. I mean, calling Angela Merkel colonna inchivabile, which translates...
You can
roughly,
say that in Italian, yeah.
I can say
right,
in Italian, yeah. Yes, which puts in question her ability to have sexual intercourse, leads, I think, to the obvious question, how does he know? Did he try?
Oh, I really don't want to get into that.
Okay.
Martin, when you watched that interview, was it sort of... You know, with tears of joy, tears of sadness, were you laughing with a well, it was it just, a happy face?
It was just fascination. I mean, he is such a plastic figure. I mean, you look at his hair and it is entirely recreated. You look at his face and he is orange. I've never seen a colour of a politician like that. Orange. I mean, it's because he's, you know, had such skin, facelifts, tanning oils. God knows what he does to himself. It's just extraordinary. I mean, he's a creation. I mean, a man who used to be a crooner on a cruise ship, and yet he had the support and the affection of, you know, millions of Italians who felt they were just like him, because he was into football, he was into women, he was prepared to pinch their bums, and they knew it. And that was what they loved about him. He was just like them.
And John, he is an anti-politician, isn't he?
He's an anti-politician. Look, I can't resist saying that the other thing I really love about this interview was his discussion about leaping out behind a pillar saying cuckoo. Later in the interview, he says he did this because this is what Vladimir Putin did to him. So now we know, everybody. All this time we think our leaders are spending hours negotiating behind closed doors, trying to solve the world's problems. What are they doing? They're hiding behind pillars, leaping out and saying cuckoo to each other.
Martin, one of the things that always astonished me when I was reporting across Africa was the respect that so many people had for Vladimir Putin and, to a lesser extent, Silvio Berlusconi. But in both characters, saw them as being the sort of the anti-American, standing up for the little guy against the big guy.
No, oh, absolutely. But then, you know, of course, every African both hates America, but also desperately wants to have a green card, would love to be there. So it's this kind of love-hate relationship. But, you know, I think that somebody like Berlusconi is a little bit like Farage in this country, or someone like Malema in South Africa. All populists, clever with words, know how to identify themselves with the people. It's a wonderful method of staying popular.
On that note, Martin Plaut and John Everard, thank you both very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vanuit Londen. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London. This is Monocle 24.
Op London, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London, London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monocle 24.
Lots still to come in the second half of Midori House. We'll be in Lisbon, we'll be talking about TV, and we'll also be talking about fashion. But before all that, here's Paul Osborne with the world news headlines.
Almost 50 people are feared dead in the latest attacks on villages in the northeast of Nigeria to be blamed on Islamist militants. Three villages were targeted close to the town, and more than 200 schoolgirls were abducted by Boko Haram more than a month ago. People living there were shot and buildings were set on fire the day after 118 people were killed in a double bomb attack in the country. Russia has agreed to supply China with natural gas in a massive multi-billion dollar deal, which will last for three decades. It was signed by the Russian President Vladimir Putin after negotiations lasting a decade. Precise details haven't been released, but it's thought to be worth up to $400 billion. And the news of that deal came as the US Vice President Joe Biden warned it was vital that European nations find an alternative to their reliance on Russian energy supplies. Egypt's former president Hosni Mubarak's been sentenced to 3 years in prison for embezzling public funds. Meanwhile, 155 members of the Muslim Brotherhood have been given long prison sentences in another mass trial. More than 50 of them were sentenced to life. And a two-hour emergency meeting of political leaders in Thailand ended with no conclusive result the day after the army imposed martial law. They discussed political reforms and ways to end months of demonstrations in the country, and they will meet again on Thursday. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Paul Osborne. It is 18:32 here in London, 14:32 in Rio. Time now for us to head to Lisbon. A little earlier, I spoke to our contributor there, Saima Tariq. Now, tens of thousands of Spaniards, in fact, Madristas, are all crossing the border to Lisbon for this weekend. Tell us why.
Well, the Champions League final has two Madrid teams, Real Madrid and Atletico. So the rivalry is already pretty intense. They've both made it to the final of what is Europe's biggest soccer football league. So there's going to be plenty of them coming over here. I mean, it's a five-hour drive away from the Portuguese capital. There's a lot of preparation going on.
What sort of reception are they likely to get? Is there going to be lots of people in Lisbon excited about the fact that you're hosting the Champions League final, that all these Spaniards are coming over?
It depends who you talk to, obviously. I mean, City Hall are going to be doing very well from this. There is a lot of potential for a lot of money to be spent, especially at night time, because plenty of Spaniards, whatever team wins, will be celebrating in the Bairros. I know a lot of people are also leaving for the weekend because, I mean, for a city that has the inner city, the population is about 500,000. So if 70,000 Spaniards come in, that is going to make a huge difference on quite a wild weekend. At the same time, it shouldn't be too chaotic. There is a mega operation involving the police, the National Guard, the Maritime Police. There even is talk of a drone, one of Portugal's first police drones that would be following the movements of the fans. And in general, they will be tried to be kept separate.
And has much been made of the fact that Lisbon's hosting this? Is it something that people are quite proud of, given that, you know, it hasn't been the easiest of times for Portugal in the last few years? Or for most people, is it a kind of, it's passing them by?
I guess the feeling really is that the money is needed, I suppose, for City Hall. But there will be, obviously, there are a lot of football fans in Lisbon, of course. I mean, their major team, Benfica, lost another league recently. So there will be a lot of interest, and maybe the influx of people might make things a little bit more celebratory. But yeah, it will definitely be a fun weekend for a lot of people who are into the league.
Now, we mentioned the economy in Portugal. If you listen to Portugal's economy minister, then everything's back on the right track. It's a rather simplistic way of looking at things, though, isn't it?
It is, yes. I mean, they are on the right track in terms of relying on foreign exports as a way to meet the budget deficit. But there is a shock drop in GDP. And I mean, the focus on export as well as tourism is kind of a volatile hopes in an economic system that still has incredibly low wages of pay, that are still going through with various tax cuts, although that might be overturned because an election is coming in 2015. So the government here is very wary of that, and they will talk about reversing some of the policies of austerity. Many people are still experiencing it, especially outside of the capital city. Poverty levels are actually rising, and unemployment is stable at the moment. But yeah, it's a complicated issue. I mean, this progress will be incremental, I suppose.
And obviously, the economy is going to play a big part in tomorrow's elections, European elections. It will play a big part across Europe. In Portugal, we haven't necessarily seen, though, that despite the fact that people are obviously very angry and frustrated about the situation, we haven't seen that same shift to some of the extreme parties that we've seen elsewhere, have we?
That's true, and there are a lot of reasons for that. I mean, a lot of people are now, actually, with the exit, with the bailout exit, people are sort of reflecting on what their country is again. It almost feels like a second revolution to a lot of the left-wing politicos. But there isn't a turn to extremist politics, let's say, or they're definitely anti-Europe. But I think there is still a fear in Portuguese society about extreme politics, because they recently this year also celebrated the 40th anniversary of the revolution, which was the end of a fascist regime. Yeah, the elections that we're going to see, probably the socialists maintaining the seats.
Simon Tariq there in Lisbon. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Much more still to come, including up next, we'll look at the future of fashion.
You're listening to Monocle 24, broadcasting from Midori House at 1 Dorset Street, London W1. Monocle 24 is a wholly owned subsidiary of Win Content and is edited by Tyler Brulé and Andrew Tuck. With bureaus in Tokyo, Hong Kong, Zurich and New York, Monocle 24 has over 50 editors and correspondents filing for us around the clock. If you have any editorial, distribution or advertising queries, please email us at info@monocle.com. Monocle. Keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
All around the world, Monocle 24's growing network of correspondents bring you the latest news, reportage and insight.
For Monocle in Istanbul, I'm Joseph Dana.
For Monocle in Jordan, I'm Nigel Wilson.
For Monocle in New York, I'm Tristan McAllister.
For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Kimberly Brown.
For Monocle in Accra, I'm Jocelyn Edwards.
For Monocle in Tel Aviv, I'm Marika Peters.
From New York to Nairobi, Bamako to Berlin.
For Monocle in San Francisco, I'm Alistair G.
For Monocle in Belgrade, I'm Guy Delorme.
For Monocle in Rio de Janeiro, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
For Monocle in New York, I'm Megan Dietrich.
For Monocle in Igualada, I'm Lee Mulders.
So whether you want to know what's happening in the corridors of power, in the boardrooms of the aviation giants, or the must-sees at the latest film festival, stay tuned to Monocle 24. Keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. It's 18:39 here in London and 13:39 in New York City. What's the future of the clothing industry? Will fashion always be fast, and what technological developments will determine what we wear and how we wear it. That's the focus of a new documentary film. It's called The Next Black, and it's released globally today on YouTube. Joining me here in the studio is Luvisa Sunnerholm, one of the film's producer, and also Louise Lundberg, in charge of the documentary's release strategy. Louise and Luvisa, welcome to the programme. Before we talk to you, let's hear a little bit of a clip of the film.
I think the whole fashion industry's had a wake-up call. This is a method of producing fashion which is closer to brewing beer.
I think sooner rather than later, you're going to see more and more sensors and more clothes.
Like, I've had this for 9 years now, and I wear it all the time. It's held up very well. I kind of like the design of it.
I think our relationship with clothes in 20 years will be really interesting. I wonder if we'll even wear clothes or we'll fully have digital skin.
We're going to get to that question in a moment. Louisa, before we delve into it too deeply, tell us a little bit about the film and the idea behind it.
So I work at AEG, and I mean, we are in the business of taking care of clothes. And in order to do that, we need to know, you know, not only what is new in fashion, but what is next within the clothing industry. And instead of sitting only in our lab researching, we want to be out in the world meeting with the pioneers, because there are many pioneers out there who are working to change the clothing industry. So we think that we'll see a dramatic shift. I mean, both with the technology moving into the apparel we wear, but also new sustainable practices that will shift the whole concept of clothing.
And Louise, what's so important about this message that the film's trying to get across at the moment? Why is it that now you think is the right time for these issues to be talked about?
Well, I think one of the reasons why the documentary is called The Next Black is not The New Black. And it's also because we're seeing, I mean, I think it's a lot of discussions, and we see all the new collections and the new colors and everything that's about to happen within the fashion industry. And what we want to do with the film together with AEG is to more look into the next movement, which is not about the next designer or the next color or catwalk fashion. It's more about what's going to happen when we are turning technology within the way we wear, and how as the film says as well, perhaps in the future we won't even have a wardrobe. Instead we might have just digital skin. And that's also something that we
about that question. I mean, really? I mean, Louisa, really? Do you genuinely believe that? I must say, whenever I hear these sorts of, you know, it's not just about fashion, but whenever anyone says, oh, in the future, you know, whether it's, there'll be jetpacks, there'll be flying cars. We were supposed to have jetpacks by now, and we don't. But do you genuinely think that there could be something like digital skin that people would wear? Or is that just a bit fantastical?
No, but I would say, and especially after talking to Nancy Tilbury, I mean, she is really, as she says in the documentary, it will come like a tsunami. And I also think, I mean, that whole perspective, when actually, and what we do in the documentary, we merge the perspectives of technology and sustainability, and how technology actually can be the thing that makes the whole clothing industry more sustainable. So, I mean, what she is talking about, instead of having 10 different shirts, you can have one. And you can, you can subscribe.
Is that a good thing, though? Would you actually want to have just one shirt? Because, I mean, this is, you know, I think a lot of people think, well, actually, I'd quite like to have.
I mean, I don't think
ones.
It's about, I mean, having one shirt. And I think, I mean, yes, we've been talking about, I mean, wearable technology for quite a long time now. But I think, I mean, just the fact that, what if we will have digital skin in the future? I mean, we're not saying that that it's definite that we will. But, I mean, imagine subscribing to your friends or a designer's social channels like Tumblr or Instagram in one way. You could subscribe to the new content and it automatically turns out into the dress or the shirt that you're wearing. And I think that's, I mean, for me, as I'm a super big nerd on Instagram and Tumblr for that matter. And I get all excited just by thinking that I could have like my own dress instead of having Stella McCartney's flower print. I could have my own print that I just took on Instagram, and I'm going to have it, I mean, all around my body, sort of. I mean,
and
it's
does this,
quite radical. It's a radical thought.
Well, it is, but actually, is it also, in a sense, Louisa, a bit you know, it kind of comes from this feeling that a lot of people have at the moment that, well, I can just go to, so many clothes now are so cheap, you know, at a certain end of the scale, that you can just, you know, buy one outfit, wear it a couple of times, and then think, right, I'm going to buy something else. So it's kind of tapping into that. I've seen this on Instagram and now I can go out and buy something like that and it's not going to cost me too much. And then I'll see something else in a week's time and I can buy that.
And that's exactly one of the questions that we want to raise. I mean, I think the whole clothing industry, it's skewed up in so many ways. And I mean, in the world where we are, where you can buy clothes so cheap, in one way, AG, we are not needed, you know, because you don't need to launder your clothes. You don't need to care for them. And that is exactly, we want to make people, you know, love your clothes and care for them over a long time.
Is this actually something to celebrate, or is it actually something that, you know, when you think of the clothes and everyone's got something in their wardrobe which they've had for a very long time and they really love, and they'll always wear it, you know, and they'll certainly keep it and hope it comes back into fashion. But it's something that's incredibly well made and handcrafted and they know exactly where all the materials come from. And this, Louise, seems to be almost the opposite of that.
I mean, how do I respond to that question? But I'm just thinking that we're not really talking about maybe the more, as we can see in a lot of other documentaries and other films, like the way we produce clothes in a more handcrafted way. I think the interesting thing here is just like the way that, I mean, what if in the future you can just grow your own clothing using kombucha culture? You know, it's, as also one of the cases from Biocouture says in the film, and I think it's just so many different ways that we can just start to think about clothing that we haven't even thought about before.
And I think that, I mean, we have had really much positive feedback from people that have seen it, that, you know, all the different perspectives that you gather into one film. So it's both about the manufacturing, it's about the caring, it's about the different kind of fabrics, but also how, you know, technology can actually change. As with the Adidas, for example, one of the cases in the documentary, you know, how it can increase our performance. How far can we take that? What happens with that when that hits the streets?
Did you find, Louisa, when you were making this film, that you were constantly being surprised? Did you come at it quite sceptical at first about when people start talking about the more fantastical elements of how fashion can change? And did your views change on this sort of throughout the making of the film?
I mean, everything that, for example, Nancy has shared, she is so provoking and she has far out ideas. But, you know, when you meet her and when you talk to her, in one, you know, it actually makes sense. But then also with all the different, I mean, all the facts and statistics about, for example, when dyeing clothes, every year, as much water as half of the Mediterranean is used for dyeing clothes. I had no idea. So, I mean, we have come across so many different facts that is just, it's really skewed how it is. So so I think also with dry dye, for example, dyeing clothes with zero water. So, and that is just one small part of the whole manufacturing process. But still, it can make such a big change. And I think that's very interesting.
Louisa Sonneholm and Louise Lundberg, thank you both very much indeed. The film is The Next Black. It is released today on YouTube. Do go and watch it. Music now. It's Fashion, David Bowie. Fashion there by Bowie. We're going to be talking TV after this. It's Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. Welcome back. To end the show, we're going to talk about TV. I have with me here Alice Vincent from The Daily Telegraph. Alice, welcome to Midori House.
Hi, hello.
We are going to save the best, by which I mean the worst, for last.
Okay.
But first, let's talk about two rather good US dramas. One which we know very well, one which some people might not know it's an hour drama. Let's start with Mad Men. I must admit, I kind of stopped with Mad Men after about the end of series 4. It was very good. I think I just stopped.
You're not alone.
What have I missed?
Well, It's Mad Men, so it takes a long time.
Yeah.
There have been plot devices, but essentially Don is still, you know, maybe sleeping with other women. You know, there's still intrigue within the ad firm, but it's still beautiful. It's still so gripping. It's still so cleverly written.
And it's part of the reason why it's so good, because so much other drama is so formulaic, or is it just, you know, fantastic writing and acting?
I think the formulaic argument could definitely be applied to Mad Men as well, but I think it's so cleverly written. They do, you know, a lot of thematic writing. The characters are so beautifully portrayed, and they're not afraid to write TV where not much happens. I think that's the best thing about it.
Let's hear a quick clip from last night's episode of Mad Men.
We'd like you to come back to work.
This is the best place to be right now, Don.
Why am I even here?
Why are you here?
I'm prepared to leave the agency.
You think this is going to save you, don't you?
We lost Chevy.
You knew?
Are you just going to kill yourself?
Why can't I reach you? Who's your new girl, Don?
There we are. Rather dramatic there.
It was quite dramatic, considering I said nothing just happened.
They managed to crown quite a lot into that. And the thing is, it's also been a huge success, not just in America, obviously, but, you know, on the other side of the Atlantic Ocean as well. Mm-hmm. What is it you think that has made it attractive to British audiences?
I think it's got a sort of stoicism to it. I think
we like stoicism.
Yeah, we're quite good at that. And I think the retro charm appeals to Brits. But I also think that it rewards its loyal followers. Like you, a lot of people maybe stopped partway through the season. But there's also, I know people who are picking up season one now and still going with it to get to the seventh season. So
it's got, yeah, it is a box set classic, yeah. which people always dip into. Let's now talk about Fargo, which, as I say, most people probably just think was a film from the mid-90s, mm-hmm. 1996, if you were wondering. But it's now become a TV series as well. Alice, before we talk about it, let's hear this trailer.
If that was me, I would have killed that man. If you don't stand up to the boss, the wife, you're just gonna get washed away.
You okay there, Bill?
Wife made spaghetti for dinner.
Seemed a shame to barf it up.
Gambling problem, I heard.
You don't say.
I heard drugs.
I heard he like slept with a 13.
For Pete's sake, Bob, don't spread rumors. No, I was gambling.
I'm glad my husband's dead. I'm gonna sing at his funeral. La 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 la
la la la la. Fargo there, perhaps not for everyone. But if you have seen the film, what's quite interesting is that it kind of alludes to certain things that storylines, some incidental, some not, that happened in the film.
Mm-hmm. I think the greatest comparison between the TV series and the film is in style and humour and bizarre, funny things happening. And what's quite amazing, there's very deliberate nods to the Coen brothers, but not in the plot. I mean, there's obviously murder, but it's not that elaborate, complicated, fool you once, fool you twice plot that you see with the Coen brothers film.
Okay. And now let's end with I Wanna Marry Harry, which, okay, now before you explain what it is, let's just hear this.
We pull up to this castle.
I'm in Downton Abbey.
There's butlers and maids standing there to greet you with English accents. It was the cutest thing ever.
I wonder when we're meeting Prince Charming.
I know.
Sir is going to arrive by helicopter, and the ladies are going to be gently having afternoon tea on the lawn, and then they're going to see someone who looks very well known step out. He'll be rushed away, and they then will spend hours debating who they think it is.
Oh my God. Is that who I think it is?
Where do we start with this? Alice, explain what on earth that was all about.
Well, you've got to mix the highbrow with the lowbrow.
Yep, that's fine.
It's basically, it's possibly the dating show to end all dating shows, in the sense that it's reality TV.
I hope it does
TV.
End all dating shows.
Well, it'll go out with a bang then. You know, it's, at no point does his name is Matthew Hicks, he's a Prince Harry lookalike, he's actually blonde, he dyes his hair ginger, at no point does he say he's Harry, but the ladies infer that he is, and hilarity ensues, I think, is the idea. Whether in reality is a different thing.
It's a bit cruel, isn't it, asking him to dye his hair ginger? Now, is this something that is just an opportunity for British people to laugh at Americans, or is there anything, I was going to say, is there anything deeper about it? I mean, obviously it's not deeper, but is there any more entertainment other than that?
I mean, it's like any dating show. Some people really enjoy them on a sort of trash level.
It's like The Bachelor. It's like Joe Millionaire.
Exactly.
It's of that sort of ilk.
Yeah. It's like that meets Made in Chelsea. So it's sort of in some ways perfect if you're into that.
That's almost exactly how it probably would have been pitched, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's Joe Millionaire meets Made in Chelsea.
Yeah.
Damn it, yeah. I should be thinking of these sorts of things. Okay, right. Before you come back next time, yeah. You need to think up your own little sort of...
pitch.
Yeah. There needs to be some sort of pitch like that. Okay, so I Want to Marry Harry is on TV here in the UK and in the US as well?
It's on Fox in America at the moment. It's coming to the UK later this year. So.
I can barely
bated
wait.
Bated breath.
Fargo. Of course, is on both sides of the Atlantic, as is Mad Men. If you haven't obviously caught up with Mad Men at all, then you can obviously just get the box set, as I might dip back into now. Alice Vincent from The Daily Telegraph, thank you very much.
You're
indeed
welcome,
for joining us on Midori House. That is pretty much all we have time for today. Thank you very much to all my guests, but in particular John Everard and Martin Plout. Midori House was produced by Daniel Giacopelli. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Carlotta Ribello. The studio manager was Joel Church. Next up, after the headlines, it's The Entrepreneurs. And then, of course, later at 2200 hours, it's The Monocle Daily. Midori House will be back at the same time tomorrow. It's 1800 hours here in London, 1300 hours in New York City. But from all of us here, my name's Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.
Beijing.
This is Monocle 24.
Nach Amsterdam.
A Bogota.
To Hong Kong.
All around the world.
This is Monocle 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster Perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world-famous, Oyster Perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.